Here is Lisa Wexler.
We have a great show for you today, and we have a lot of information to catch you up on. At 10:30 this afternoon, John Eberle from the Connecticut Department of Transportation is going to be on our show to talk about, he's going to talk about the new proposals for the entire Route 7 15 interchange, the one that was such a mess years ago that a judge stopped it. And the DOT had us take a step backward. And now there are several plans. They're available online for us to look at and discuss. But I'm not a very good visual learner. I'm a much better audio learner. That's why I'm a devoted radio listener like you. And so I wanted John Eberle to come on today and explain exactly what our choices are. So that's what he's going to do. 203-333-9422. Melanie Coleman's tragic death when I saw this beautiful young gymnast dying in what the family is describing as a freak accident. Of course, I want to know why and what happened. And we're going to get into it a little bit later in the show. But the short answer is it was a freak accident. She was in Yale Hospital over the weekend from a Friday to a Sunday. She died on Sunday. Her organs are apparently being made available by her family for donation to other people. So they are literally waiting for people who need her organs. She was a nursing student, a junior at Central Connecticut University. And she had trained for years. She was originally part, not Central Connecticut, Southern Connecticut State University, Southern. She was one of five siblings, three of whom were talented gymnasts just like herself, three sisters. The family is obviously devastated. There's a GoFundMe campaign that, as of this morning, has raised over $50,000. And if you're somebody familiar with going on the internet and Facebook, you can easily find the GoFundMe campaign, which is when families or friends of families ask for donations in order to help pay for the unexpected expenses associated with a tragedy or an obstacle. It's a very common way for families to raise money nowadays. Services are incomplete at this time. If you knew the family, perhaps you know more than I do. But right now, publicly, the services are not available in order to let us know where we want to pay our condolences. And we'll get into a little bit more about she... But Melanie was a beloved Milford resident. She went to Jonathan Law High School. Her family very active in the schools. And altogether, this is just an extraordinary tragedy of an all-American, brilliant, young, talented, vivacious, everything good you can say about a young girl on the brink of continuing a life. She was it. She was it, Melanie Coleman. And all of us as parents and all of us as individuals who participate in anything every day, we know that there's risk involved. We know there's risk involved every time we get behind the wheel of a car, we go on an airplane. But there's particular risk involved in some sports, horseback riding, gymnastics. We know this. We know Christopher Reeve. We remember him becoming paralyzed, doing something he loved the most, which was competing in a race, doing jumping in horses. And we know intellectually that freak accidents can happen. Apparently, she fell off one of the pieces of apparatus doing a gymnastics routine that she had probably done thousands of times. Anyway, it's a terrible tragedy. When I saw it yesterday, I was overcome, as I'm sure you are, at just the terrible loss of life and what happened and what happened and what happened. The truth is we don't really know any details other than what was described as a freak accident, something that injured her spine from which she then could not recover. 203-333-9422, but our condolences go out to the entire Coleman family this morning. And we're thinking about you and we're thinking about Melanie. 10 minutes after the hour, 203-333-9422. There is breaking news that has enormous implications starting right here in Bridgeport, that will have enormous implications on the law of the land with respect to gun rights and with respect to gun control. So let me tell you what the law is, what the breaking news is. The breaking news, the simple headline, is that the Supreme Court has refused to take an appeal. So you say, oh, okay, the Supreme Court refused to take an appeal. They refused to take thousands of appeals. They refused to take an overwhelming number of appeals. If they took every appeal that was appealed to the Supreme Court, they could never sit in session. They'd be so busy going through paperwork. So what am I talking about? Why is this important? Well, the law firm of Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter, led by Josh Koskoff, decided on behalf of the families of Sandy Hook that they were going to try and challenge the federal law that was passed by Congress a while ago that essentially exempted, made the gun owners immune from any liability with respect to guns that they sold. Now, that was not always the case. That was not always the law of the land. But the NRA had a lot of clout, and there are a lot of people around the country who felt, look, you can't blame a gun company for a criminal who gets hold of a gun. That's not fair. That's like blaming every knife manufacturer for somebody who stabs someone. We don't want to do that. We decide as a matter of public policy that if every gun manufacturer was responsible for every criminal act, that it wouldn't be fair to the vast majority of gun owners that are lawful, law-abiding citizens. And so we've decided as a Congress, as America that has a representative form of government, that we are passing this law that says we don't think that gun owners can ever and should ever, ever be held responsible for anything that happens with their guns. Big law, big immunity. And that immunity has essentially insulated, protected gun owners from lawsuits. Now, what happened after Sandy Hook was the families of Sandy Hook Promise and others. Sandy Hook Promise is a particular group that was an offshoot of some parents, but there are others. And they said, you know what? We think this law stinks. We think this law is awful. Because we believe that we have accumulated enough evidence to show that the gun owners should be responsible because they are affirmatively marketing AR-15s and other weapons of mass destruction to teenagers and unstable individuals and people that are absorbed in a world of virtual reality on video games. And they are branding their AR-15s in very insensitive ways throughout these very violent video games and in other places. And we think, much as the cigarette companies were accused of doing, we think that the gun companies, they are not bystanders in this acceleration of gun violence. They are partners in this acceleration of gun violence. So say the families of Sandy Hook Promise and many others who are among the people who are victims of gun violence, whether they be families or walking around maimed as a result of a wound. And so, on behalf of Sandy Hook Promise, the law firm of Koskoff decided that they would sue and try and challenge this immunity of gun manufacturers. Now, predictably, they didn't have much success in state court in Connecticut because it's a federal law. And we have something in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause, which means that if a federal law is made, it overrides, it supersedes a state law. And so predictably, the Sandy Hook Promise families were not successful in overturning the congressional immunity statute. But what did they do? They came up with a novel theory. And the theory they came up with was, you know what? Yeah, there's the federal statute, and we know we can't get anywhere with that, unfortunately. We've tried, but we've not succeeded. But we have something in Connecticut called the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. And that's also known as CUTPA. That is the acronym, C-U-T-P-A, the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, known as CUTPA. And we think CUTPA is different than the federal immune statute. It has different criteria. It's a state statute. It's alongside a federal statute. But we believe that to prove liability under CUTPA is not exactly all the same elements as that's contained in the federal law. And so, Your Honor, they said to the state Supreme Court in Connecticut, we think we should be able to try this case in front of a jury on CUTPA. Putting aside the federal, we're sorry we lost on that, but we think we should be able to try the case. And lo and behold, the Connecticut Supreme Court said, yeah, I think you've got a point. We're not saying the gun manufacturers are liable. But on the other hand, we're not saying that you can't try the case, that you can't have it, what we call a cause of action under CUTPA, that you can't proceed under CUTPA. And so the Connecticut Supreme Court, making law, decided that perhaps the gun manufacturers could be held liable under CUTPA. and that they had a cause of action, the plaintiffs, but now they would go back and try the case and see, in fact, if a fact finder like a jury decided that, in fact, there were violations under CUTPA. And by the way, if there are violations under CUTPA, there are punitive damages, there are treble damages, there's all kind of money that can be paid because CUTPA is a pretty significant state law. Now, the gun manufacturers went berserk and they said, holy cow, you're telling me we could be liable for our guns because of the way we market our guns to individuals? You're telling us that this federal immunity may not apply in Connecticut? We're going to appeal this to the Supreme Court. And we fully expect them to take the case because, you know, there are national interests at stake here and we're gun manufacturers. And guess what happened today? Literally breaking news 7 minutes before this hour. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal. Now, what happens when they refuse to hear the appeal is that that means that Connecticut Supreme Court law stands. And I want you to understand and think about what that means in terms of our 50 states nationwide. Because other states, just like Connecticut, have their state versions of Unfair Trade Practices Act. And there are people from Las Vegas to Louisiana to Orlando, Florida, you name the state, and I will tell you of a mass shooting incident. Am I right? There's almost one a week in this country. Texas, South Carolina. I mean, it goes on and on. And with respect to those states that have those consumer unfair trade practices acts like ours, you can bet and you can believe they're waking up this morning and they're rubbing their hands together. And the victims of those mass gun violence incidents are saying, if they can do it in Connecticut, we can do it here. Watch the lawsuits begin. Ladies and gentlemen, watch. Watch what happens. Because around the country, people are paying attention to this Remington Arms case. And around the country, people are saying, if they could do it in Connecticut, why not do it in Virginia? Why not do it in Florida? Why not do it in Texas? Why not do it in Nevada? Why not do it in California? Is there any state that has escaped a mass violent incidents with guns? I don't know the answer, but I'm guessing not too many. So this is huge news. It's a very big victory substantively for the families in Sandy Hook Promise, because now they can proceed to argue. Remember, they haven't persuaded a jury yet that Remington Arms is in fact guilty of anything. And it may be that they're not guilty. But now they can at least try it. They can try the case. And that is enormous news for people who are watching gun rights and gun violence and who are active Connecticut against gun violence. For all of the people today, they are, I'm sure, the people in Sandy Hook Promise, the victims of gun violence, are cheering because this could be the beginning of chipping away at that federal immunity statute. I'm Lisa Wexler, 203-333-9422. We will take your calls right after this. So we were just chatting. Welcome back to the show, 203-333-9422. And what could be one of the biggest stories of the year? The fact that the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take the Remington Arms appeal means that here in Connecticut alone, with respect to challenging the immunity of gun manufacturers, the state, the plaintiffs who are Sandy Hook Promise and others, can proceed on challenging the fact that the Remington Arms violated the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, what is called CUTPA, the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. And in doing so, might be able to persuade a jury or a fact finder that Remington Arms should have to pay big money for the way in which the allegations are that they marketed AR-15s and other weapons to people with an idea towards selling the guns to people who should not, in fact, have had the guns. And they will make their arguments. But what is so huge about this is that if it can be done in Connecticut, it can and will be done elsewhere. And this opens up, frankly, a Pandora's box for Remington Arms and other gun manufacturers. It is a true warning shot across the bow to the immunity that Congress has granted to gun manufacturers. And it's a blanket immunity. It basically means you don't even get to try and prove your case and have your case fail on its facts. You don't even get there because of the blanket immunity. So this is huge, because this opens up an alternative way in many state courts for victims of gun violence to challenge the immunity of gun manufacturers. Let's go to Wayne from Bridgeport. Wayne, I thank you for holding. Hi, welcome to the show today.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I can.
Okay.
All right. Your show is, you know, you've got my brain taken. I was sitting and go like, oh, my God. And I hope that people, you described it extremely well, but I hope people understand it's like Connecticut, which had such a horrific shooting that has been at the forefront of these protests well before everyone else, in every way possible, has a chance to set the precedent. You know, the precedent basically is that this state will have a decision one way or the other, and obviously we hope it's the way we want it to be, that dictates what happens in other states through this particular law that gets totally around the NRA, which has a lot of effect on what the Supreme Court takes up, or even, you know, sometimes in Congress. So this is wonderful, and it can bring a lot of satisfaction to a lot of families. And they're basically, I'm sure, waiting with bated breath to see what happens in Connecticut, because they truly do market to young people, women, all, you know, it's the best thing ever. The AR, I mean, I get this thing coming to my email. It's got
Do you really? Stuff. Do you really, Wayne? Yeah. Yeah, they haven't found me, you know. I'm not, you know, I don't know. They haven't found me yet, but I have been reading about the aggressive marketing. And I read the case, part of the complaint. And, you know, the complaint details very specific facts about how Remington and these other gun manufacturers specifically target their market. They're not bystanders. They want to sell guns.
Oh, yes, yes. And they have women in sexy outfits. They've got kids. They've got all kind of... And they might not be kids, because I'm sure if you pull the thing, they're like they're 18 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they're absolutely marketing to the sexiness and the importance of having the gun for macho-ality, you know, and all the things that go with it. So it's kind of like the vaping thing that's going on. Oh, it's the best thing to help you stop smoking, but they're marketing at kids. You know, it is what it is. So this is what's wonderful to me right now, and it just feels so good to see that Connecticut could very well be at the forefront
leader
of this.
No question.
The leader, man.
But it also tells you that as conservative a Supreme Court as we thought that we had, you know, it takes only 4 out of 9 to accept a writ of certiorari. That's the fancy Latin word for accepting the appeal. And the writ of certiorari is the writ that a Supreme Court would accept for then deciding a case. So it only takes 4, and it means that there were not 4 votes to try and take this on, which tells you something. Even in a very conservative Supreme Court, they want the states to be able to deal with this gun rights issue. I think it's really indicative of the way a lot of people on the Supreme Court are thinking about gun rights and gun violence right now. I really do. Because if they really wanted to squash this down on the right of supremacy and everything else, they could have gotten 4 votes to take the case. And the fact that they are not taking the appeal is hugely significant. Hugely.
Oh, so. and they know better than we do what that means. And it's really wonderful. And I love your show.
Another
so
caller.
Much.
Oh, thank you. Go right ahead. Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome.
I'm going to go to Linda now from Stratford. Linda, hi. Thank you for calling today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So what are your thoughts about this?
I was saying that in this situation, when Remington's gone, they should...
I can't. Linda, this is not a good connection. Every other word, we are having trouble hearing you.
Oh, I don't know what the problem is. Did you hear me now?
Yes. Right now I can. So wherever you are, don't move.
Okay. I was just saying that I've been trying to call you on another situation where they have something in Connecticut where if someone rents a car or something like that, someone steals somebody's car and they go out to have an accident or do damage, they're trying to say that the owner of the car that has the insurance is not liable. And that's the case. It's the same thing with the gun. With the gun, where they're trying to say that the person that Remington would be responsible. And that's the case. In my situation, the insurance is responsible. The person who rented the car that had the insurance, they go out and they do all this damage. Like in my situation, somebody rented a car and they went and did all this damage, crashed into 3 cars, totaled my car. They're trying to say that the insurance company not responsible because the car was stolen. And we sat there, watched the guy physically get out the car. It was like five witnesses get out and run. But yet and all, the insurance is trying to fight it, trying to say they're not responsible.
They're trying to say they're not responsible because the stealing of it was an intervening criminal act, and therefore they don't think that they're responsible? Is that what
That's
you're
what
saying?
But the car has insurance, and it should be responsible because each car has insurance on it. That's what you pay insurance for.
Okay.
In case anything happens.
I hear you, Linda. I don't know what to tell you, except you need to get the advice of an attorney. And there are many attorneys who will give you advice free because it's...
No, there is no attorneys in the state of Connecticut. The only thing they want to do is handle slip and fall and car accidents.
Right, but this
All
is a car accident.
All the attorneys they had years ago are dead.
Well, this is a car
They're
accident.
They're up in a nursing
Linda.
Home.
Linda, this is a car accident, isn't it?
Yeah, but I wasn't in the car. That's the reason why they don't want to take the case.
Oh, it's just the damage to the car.
The car was sitting near parked.
I
the car
see.
Was sitting near parked.
Yeah, I hear you. So it's not a personal injury matter. Right, it's strictly money. I got it. It's strictly property. Right. Well, I can't help you, Linda. I'm sorry. I can't help you. I don't do legal advice.
But if they try to say Remington, if they could get sued for what they did, they're not responsible. Hey, well, I could sue because, look.
I hear
they, didn't know that they were going to do that.
Right. I hear the analogy you're making, Linda, and I thank you for the call. We're going to go now to some messages, WICC 600, WICC600.com, and we're going to speak with John Eberle from the Connecticut Department of Transportation coming right up. And welcome back. It's 1032 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. Our next conversation is with John Eberle, who is a principal with Stantec Consulting and a civil engineer, primarily working in the transportation engineering field. He's been in the industry for 35 or so years, and he works currently for the Connecticut Department of Transportation as a consultant on the 715 interchange, you know, the Route 7, the Merritt around Route 7, right around exits 39, that big hill that we climb up on the way to Bridgeport, and the one that we climb down on the way back towards the New York border. And this interchange has been a mess for a long time, and the DOT has intervened years ago, and it had its wrist slapped by a judge, and everything stopped. But I want to find out more about the specifics of what is being proposed right now, and I invite you to call as well, 203-333-9422. John Eberle, thank you for joining us today. Hi, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, John, let's just give a little history here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't exactly remember the year, but it was a while ago.
Yep.
The neighbors around that Norwalk area woke up and all the trees were gone.
Yep.
And they weren't very happy.
Right.
And they went to the court and they said, excuse me, Connecticut Department of Transportation, what the heck did you just do? And the court said, you didn't have authority to do what you did. And everything was put at a standstill. Could you explain, John Eberle, were you with the Connecticut Department of Transportation then when that happened?
No, we came on in the recent incarnation of this. So we've been on since 2016. As you indicated, you know, this project goes back 20-odd years. So back in 2005, the DOT actually went to construct the preferred design at that time. As you indicated, a number of stakeholders sued, and the judge did come back and indicated that the documentation, the environmental process, was not totally followed. There were certain, you know, issues that they needed to address. So at that point, quite frankly, the state could have fixed the environmental documentation, reached out, and continued on. But what they decided to do is they kind of stepped back and they got a stakeholder group together, a project advisory committee together, and they worked with them to try to see if they could solve the issues or what the real elements were. And they did that, and they actually came up with a preferred alternate called 21C at the time. And they were ready to go forward at that point. So that's circa 2006. Unfortunately, the money, you know, we entered the recession, as we all recall, and there was just no funding. So that's why the project ended at that point. And now it's just been recently, since 2016, we've been on board working with the department and stakeholders and trying to move this forward down the road.
Well, first of all, we know Connecticut is hardly flush right now.
Right.
Right? So yep. Money, I would think, is still an issue. How much are we talking about for whatever plans are being proposed either way?
Well, it depends. It depends on which alternate. And just to kind of back up, we've gone from like 28 alternates. So we kind of reopened the books just to make sure we weren't missing something.
Okay.
28 has been now narrowed down to 2 over the past few years. And we're actually moving forward with 2 alternates and doing the impact assessments, the environmental, and all that. So the question on the cost is very, at this point, we don't have a full design in front of us. We've done some preliminary engineering enough so that we can kind of assess impacts and what are we really doing to the natural and built environment. Depending on which alternate is actually chosen or the preferred alternate, the range of costs are going to be from, $100 million to $200 million. And again, depending on which alternate goes forward.
So that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so it begs the question, why are we doing anything to it right now? What is being perceived as the need to change the status quo?
Yeah, so we've done a fairly exhaustive needs and deficiencies report where we've kind of identified the project-wide deficiencies, substandard geometry, insufficient capacity, and that we've actually worked with the project advisory committee, and this essentially is the same. We call it a PAC, same PAC that was actually circa 2006, because they obviously know the issues out there. We've worked with them in developing a purpose and need statement, and I would invite you or your listeners to actually go to the website, and I can give that later. It's a fairly detailed document on what are the deficiencies, and it can go into great detail. The three basic needs of the project are to improve system linkages between Route 7 and the Merritt Parkway, improve mobility, and improve safety in the area. And if we've done a lot of outreach, and the safety is a big item out here. The number of crashes, it's just amazing how in the Merritt Parkway this stands out like a sore thumb. The bottom line on the need, and I'm going to boil it right down to, is that currently, there are no full connections between the Merritt Parkway and Route 7. So if you're coming southbound on Merritt Parkway, mm-hmm. you cannot get to Route 7. You have to get off Main Avenue and then work your way up to Gristmill or south to New Canaan, and you're using the local road networks to try to get to 7. So that's causing congestion.
Okay, now when you say 7, because I live right there.
Super 7.
So Super 7, the one that takes you to Wilton to Danbury, that's 7?
No. It basically goes from Gristmill down to
I-95. The little connector, that one that's like three exits.
Yeah, the freeway, the four-lane freeway that kind of ends at Gristmill Road.
Right. You have to get off, and you go a little bit with a couple of traffic lights, and you're right there. Right. That's
right.
True.
Yeah.
And that's a problem?
Yeah, because that causes congestion. So the idea of this is that right now, I think, talking to the outreach of, all the PAC, the general public, the Glover Avenue and Creeping Hemlock mm-hmm. intersection, just as an example, is just a mess. Right now they actually have hired a police officer to try to help direct traffic at peak moments. So when we're looking at, and we're looking, 20 years down the line, so even today, it's really kind of very congested in that area. When you look at this at 2045, it will just be a complete bottleneck. There just won't be movement. So the idea of this is to make the connections, is to alleviate that issues out there.
But you know what? We're chatting with John Eberle, 203-333-9422. Most of what the Connecticut Department of Transportation does and has done is extremely ugly. It's extremely ugly.
Yep.
You do these horrible concrete overpasses. Look what they did to the city of Hartford. Mm-hmm. They pretty much ruined it. They pretty much made it so that it was impossible to have any decent pedestrian access way. I mean, and look what, even New Haven. I mean, anytime the DOT gets involved, and I can say this to you, you're an outside consultant, but I would say it even if you're with the DOT, it really has not been good. I mean, the Merritt Parkway stands alone as one of the most beautiful roads. It's landmarked. We all know that. It's an engineering genius. It's a design of engineering genius. People have studied it since the 1930s. And for the neighborhood that lives, and I, by the way, am stuck in a lot of that gridlock a lot of the time, but I don't want to see more ugly concrete overpasses in the neighborhood.
Let me speak to that, because that's an excellent point, and it is probably the challenge that we have on this project. And I think everyone has to understand what the actual, current situation is out there. It almost is described you know, as you just described it, in the sense is that you have very open areas. It's very developed and things like that. The key challenge on this, and we've met with the Merritt Parkway Conservancy, we've met with the PAC, we've probably have met 60 to 70 times with stakeholder groups, and this is probably the number one issue. I mean, there's certainly things that we have to deal with. We have to deal with traffic. What are we doing to wetlands? What are we doing to floodplains? Those things are all being assessed. But the special sensitivity out here is that the Merritt Parkway is on the National Register.
That's right.
And we have to go through an exhausting process working with not only the Conservancy and stakeholders, but eventually the State Preservation Office to make sure that whatever we're doing, A, if it has an adverse impact to any, you know, of the designed landscape, of any of the bridges, that we're doing our due diligence in rehabbing the landscape that's out there. So I think your point is very well taken, and believe me, it has not been lost on the Department of Transportation or the consultants. And again, it is probably the one point that we're all kind of focused on. So when we're done, whatever design comes through, and again, there are very different alternatives now that we're talking about, but whichever one comes through addresses the fact of where this, the context of the project and where we are.
We're chatting with John Eberle, who is a consultant with the Connecticut Department of Transportation about the Route 715 interchange at 203-333-9422. Let me ask you something, John. I'm going to ask you to describe 21C and 21A or whatever the 21s are. But I would like to know, are you able to create a tunnel workaround so that we don't have to see some ugly concrete ramp in the air?
Well, a tunnel option has not been put on the table. A tunnel option would be, you know, so incredibly expensive, we haven't looked at that. That has not once come up. The two alternatives that we have are very different, and I mean, I think that's the point of this process. Like I said, going from 28 to 4 to 2 led us to these two. It's very hard. It's very hard on the phone to actually explain these.
But
so I'm going to give you
a
summary of what they are.
Paint the picture. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, 21C essentially is, I'm going to say, a standard interchange where you actually have free flow ramps. Okay, so someone coming down the Merritt Parkway southbound and looking to get to southbound 7 would get on an exit ramp and then come under the Merritt Parkway and eventually down to 7. So it's
like the cloverleaf, okay? Kind of thing, like the cloverleaf.
Yeah, in a sense, it's kind of a cloverleaf, and combining what's out there now. So, but the one of the keys on even 21C is one of the things that tripped up the original project, which was really, you know, brought people in an uproar.
Yep.
Is that it had elevated ramps.
Yeah.
The past solutions had these towering elevated ramps right next to the parkway.
Right.
Which totally degraded the historic character of the parkway.
Right.
So 21C, while it has, you know, free flow ramps, they are all at or below the level of the parkway, and this is one of the key considerations of this. 26, which is the other alternative that survived an exhaustive filtering process, actually makes these connections, but thinks a little bit outside of the box and actually places signalized intersections on Route 7. So instead of, you know, kind of going up to Grist Mill, folks would actually, you know, that intersection would make its way down maybe, you know, 3/4 of a mile. So they're very different. That's what's interesting here, because when we do the assessments, and we've already looked at the traffic assessment of that, you know, could that even work?
And?
And the answer is yes, it does work. But what we have to do now as far as impacts are, well, okay, it works from a traffic perspective. Does it work from a safety perspective? Does it work from an air, a noise perspective? And that's really what we're into at this very moment.
In terms of trees and looking at the vista, which one requires more actual physical dynamiting disruption to the landscape?
Well, again, we haven't gone into design, but I will say this, that if anyone goes to the website, and I'm gonna make that plug now before you kick me off the phone. But,
okay.
7-15norwalk.com.
Okay,
that's the
fine.
Project website. And the wonderful thing that we've been able to do, and the department had us do, is create design visualizations. So instead of me sitting on a phone telling you,
I know,
what
but I went on it, John. That's when I asked you on the phone. I went on it, and I remember the clover leaf versus the other one, but the other one I couldn't figure out what you were doing. I couldn't figure
26?
Out.
26?
Yeah, I couldn't.
Okay,
I couldn't
they're both on there, and I think there's
an
opportunity.
I know, but I couldn't understand it.
Okay. I don't know how to respond to that.
Well,
I mean, it's
I'm not that bright, but I'm just saying.
Going back to your point about footprint and trees and whatnot, one of the key considerations or one of the differences between the two is the actual footprint that these occupy.
Tell me.
21D is a larger footprint. It has a lot more, you know, space that you need to occupy. 26 is more compact.
Okay.
So there may be, you know, there. I think, you know, before we get fully into the assessments, there's probably, you know, smaller compact, there's probably more opportunity for rehab. Either alternative that goes, whenever it's selected as a preferred alternative, will certainly, you know, advance the landscape that's out there. So, and again, they're both, the key thing is that there are no elevated ramps associated with the with either project.
So it sounds, so if you did 26, you said there's a signal, which means when you get off the highway, there's a light.
Correct. You'd come off of, let's just say you're going southbound 15.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You've passed over Main Avenue.
Yep.
You're going to take a right.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be an interchange. That's going to come down to Route 7.
Okay.
You would have a light there.
Okay.
Then, if you wanted to go north, you would take a right. If you wanted to go to Norwalk proper, downtown, you would take a left.
Okay. So there's going to be a light. Oh, so it's going to slow down traffic on 7.
Correct. Correct.
People may not like that. They like to speed on 7.
Well, that, you know, that's going to be one of the things. And we've heard both things. I mean, we have folks in the PAC and outreach that we've dealt with that love the idea of slowing traffic on Route 7.
Yeah, I'm sure
that's
true.
There are certain folks that don't, they want it to be maintained as it is now, as a freeway, even though it's ending. It's not a freeway in the sense that
it isn't.
You've got another 30 miles.
No,
it's
exactly.
Ending 3/4 of a mile
right.
Up anyway. So it's interesting, the dynamic. We're hearing both things, and that's why we're kind of excited to be in the environmental documentation, because that's
let
a
me
lot
ask
of
this you
is
this,
going to come
John.
Out.
So let me ask you this, John Eberle. So with respect to 26, which I like the idea of it being compact, but why would you need to do all of this if you're doing a signal if it doesn't make it much faster to go from, because you're ultimately, this whole thing is about getting from 95 to 15 faster. That's what this whole thing is about.
Well, it's two things. It's not just that. It's also the congestion at, you know, if you look at Glover and Main Avenue, all the traffic that's coming off of Main Avenue now to try to get to 7 through the local road network, if that disappears, okay, it's not just, it's two things. So it's going to help the congestion at Glover Avenue, at the Main Avenue interchange, okay?
Yeah.
So that's number one. And then number two, as you say, what we're looking at now as part of the assessment is what are the time savings? You know, over, you know, right now having someone needing to get off of Main. So that'll be part of the process that we do now.
Okay, that's fair. You know, I was on the Planning and Zoning Commission and Zoning Board of Appeals of my own town in Westport for many years, and I am a big land preservation, conservation, open space person.
Yep.
And the DOT in general does not impress me as putting that as numero uno on its value scale. So I'm very glad as a taxpayer and commuter that they really had to be slowed down on this project, John. I don't blame you personally. You had nothing to do with it. But the heavy-handed way in which the DOT is known in this state for going about doing what it wants, it's not a great reputation that comes with it. They really have to prove it back to the community that they're going to do the right thing.
Yeah, and I think this is a project that they look to prove that, because, and I think they've addressed that in the past, that, you know what, they've gone too far with certain things, especially in this interchange. But I think that's why, you know, they've charged us, and they're right there with us, obviously. That's why we've met, you know, 75 times over 3 years with stakeholders groups. That's why we keep going back to the Conservancy to share where we are and what we're trying to do.
So let me ask you this, John. With the imposition of tolls that Governor Lamont wants to do right there, I mean, that's going to have a slowing down impact.
Yeah, you know what? You ask the question that is above my pay grade.
All right. Well,
I'm not sure. You know, I do know that there's that this project appears on his plan, and I do know that there's a toll in this area. Where it is, what it is, we don't know that information.
Well, we're getting there. We're getting that. It's coming in by drips
and
drabs.
We're going in that direction.
We're going in that direction. John Eberle, I want to thank you very much. So
absolutely.
It's 7-15norwalk.com.
Correct. And they can see all the – it's meeting minutes. It's all the meetings that we've had with the PAC and the public and
presentations. And when is the next opportunity for the public to weigh in and let them know what you think? I mean,
yeah,
let,
so
let
we
you
just,
know
we just had – October 23rd, we had our second full general public meeting where we shared the two alternatives. Right now, we're in the environmental documentation stage. So okay. Right now, we're anticipating that in the spring of next year, we will come back out with – you know, the impact assessment's complete, and we'll start to share that with the departments or the public so that we're not just saying, I wonder if this, we don't know. We'll be able to share that. So I would think the public should be looking for this in, you know, the spring of 2020.
And who ultimately is going to decide between the two plans?
That will be, once we're done with the environmental document, that will be published, and then that will go, DOT and FHWA will kind of take a look at all the impacts, all the feedback that has been received, and then they will look and go forward with a preferred alternate based on, you know, pretty much all the evidence that they have in front of them.
You don't think they'll do what's the more expensive one?
No, I don't think that's not an automatic. So it's okay. Not just because then we wouldn't have even gone through this process if they just went, well, let's
all
go
right.
to the cheaper one.
Or well,
let's
no.
go.
Or
you know, we have
expensive.
To go through the assessment. So I think will that play a role? I think it will if, you know, the alternatives are equal.
Uh-huh.
Then I think, you know, costs would come in. But it's not the main point here. I think
okay.
it's really about assessments, impacts, and what can we do for the Merritt Parkway in this context and what the designs could be.
All right, so 7-15Norwalk.com, something we need to be paying attention to, and we can let our elected representatives know what we prefer.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
that'll
absolutely.
Have an impact as well. Thank you, John Eberle from the Department of Transportation Consultant. We really appreciate you being on the show. We hope you'll come back.
No problem. We'll do.
Thank you so much. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the show, 203-333-9422. We've been talking this morning about the DOT and its plans for the interchange on Route 15-7, and also about the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court not to take the appeal, which means they couldn't get four Supreme Court justices that wanted to tackle the issue of the immunity of gun manufacturers. And so what happens is because the state Supreme Court here in Connecticut decided that Sandy Hook Promise could go forward with a lawsuit based on the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, it opens up the possibility of getting that issue in front of a jury, of having our public right here in Connecticut sift the facts to decide whether or not the gun manufacturers ought to have liability imposed against them based on their own behavior in terms of marketing the AR-15. And this is an enormous, enormous loss for the gun manufacturing industry, because there will be likely many other kinds of consumer unfair trade protection acts in many different states. And now the victims of gun violence will see a way towards a lawsuit against gun manufacturers. Does it mean they'll win? No. But it means that they'll have an opportunity to present their case in court. Let's go to Anthony from Bridgeport. Hi, Anthony. Welcome today. Hi.
How are you?
Hi.
Okay. I speak about when they talk about the possibilities of being able to sue the gun manufacturer because that's a military weapon and it shouldn't have been on the street.
Yes. Go ahead. What's your thought on this?
My thought is this right here. God forbid I get hit by a Jeep or a Hummer.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a military vehicle and it shouldn't be on the street. You know, they market it to the people, but at the same time, they sell it.
Well, I mean, I don't think that the analogy is going to be the same. It's not a tank. It's not a tank. It's not really. I mean, Jeeps and Hummers get you from place to place. It's not the same, Anthony. It's not.
Well, at the same time.
No, it's not the same.
An AR. Is not a bomb either, you know. It's not really.
That's true.
It's not a weapon of mass destruction. It's just a fast killing machine.
Okay.
The AK-47 was called the most effective killing machine at one point.
Listen, Anthony, if you're not happy with holding gun manufacturers liable, then you could be on a jury, perhaps selected, and the jury will decide. This is really only a question of whether or not laws put in place that have been an obstacle to hearing the facts, whether or not those laws prevail. And right now, the Supreme Court said that the Connecticut Supreme Court decision prevails, which means it stands. And so this issue will get in front of a jury. Look, for many years...
I agree with this 100%, because if they let that go through, that opens the door for me to be able to say that Jeep shouldn't be on the street. You know, I mean, because that was their whole hang up at first. It was, it's a military vehicle. I mean, a military gun, a military rifle.
Well, I don't think that the analogy is necessarily going to prevail, but I appreciate the call, and I thank you for calling, Anthony. Thank you. You're welcome to call again.
You
too. It's a minute before 11 o'clock. Let me give you some news you may have missed. Incidentally, tomorrow the impeachment hearings begin. I would say it's time for some popcorn to sit in front of your television. I won't be able to, so you'll have to watch it for me and tell me what you thought. In the meantime, in other news from other places before we get to 11 o'clock, killer bushfires have sparked a state of emergency in Australia. It's unbelievable what's going on now there. They say in Sydney, the smoke is everywhere. Let me see what else I want to tell you and other news stories you may have missed. The Trump administration held an unprecedented almost 70,000 migrant kids in custody this year. 69,550 kids were held in U.S. government custody over the past year, up 42%. From 2018 alone. And the report states that approximately 4,000 children are still in government custody. More are arriving each week. And more kids have been detained away from their parents in the United States than any other country. And I really want you to hear that. Even though the U.S. government has acknowledged that being held in detention can cause long-term harm to children, some of the interviews with some of the families are coming out now, and the trauma that has been associated with little ones being separated from their parents, we're only beginning to accept and understand. It is a shanda, as they say, a disgrace. That's my voice. It's 11 o'clock. We'll be back for the next hour of the Lisa Wexler Show, 203-333-9422.